Okay, let's get started. Hi, everybody. Let me share my screen. Welcome back, class three in our new series about nature and the land of Israel. As always, we are going to be dedicating our learning to the continued refuah of all of the wounded, all of the injured, to the protection of our soldiers, and to the safe and immediate return of all the hostages. Okay, so we talked about the uniqueness of the seven species, also a little about the four species. We spent last time talking about water. Today, we are going to talk about the flora of Eretz Israel, not the seven and the four species, but others. And in addition, we're going to highlight some of the pioneering botanists and scholars who started to come back and to rediscover the land. And one of the things we mentioned this in the first class, but I'll just reiterate it here because it's very significant to what we're going to talk about. The Zionist feeling was that a return to the land is a return to the flora and the fauna and the agriculture of the land. Now, on a very basic level, that means, we have this the pioneers who come, Anu banu artsa, livnot ulibanot. We come to the land to build and to be built up. They want to be farmers. They want to create a new type of Jew. They don't want to be sitting in the Beit Midrash. They want to be out there working the land and connecting to the land. But on a deeper level, there's this feeling of we've been separated for so long from our true home, and we need to return now and to understand it again, to identify plants that were lost, their identity was lost for centuries in exile, to understand the metaphors of Tanakh, to understand the halakha of the rabbis who are also dealing with the agriculture and the plants of the land. And there's this kind of a notion, a very nationalist, very romantic notion. It doesn't only happen here, it happens in Europe as well. Among other nations, that a people is connected to its land, and understanding the land helps you to understand the people. And that's going to be part of our story that we're going to talk about today. The picture, of course, is the shkediot, almond trees. Okay? I think many of us grew up singing Hashkedia Porachat, right? That we sing for Tu B'Shvat, and in the diaspora, you sing the song, you say, "Oh, it's so beautiful, the almond trees are blossoming." When you live in the land of Israel, you really do see that the almond trees, they got the memo, they all blossom by the beginning of the month of Shvat. And they really are the first, or one of the first of the flowering trees. And I think that's important. We're going to look at the shaked, at the almonds, a little bit later when we get to specific trees and fruits. And it's already in Tanakh, that understanding of a shaked being a quick flowering, an early flowering tree. We're going to see that metaphor is used. But I also think it's important to understand how early Zionism is using the plants and the flowers of the land, right? Songs that are written for kindergarten kids, right? To understand and to connect them to the land. Okay. So this is just one example that I think all of us know, and it's a nice example. Okay. So let's start. We're going to do the first half is really going to be about these scholars, these botanists. So we will start with them. One of the first real pioneers is somebody named Aaron Aronson. If the name Aronson sounds familiar to you, but not necessarily in a botany connection, that's because you may have heard of Sarah Aronson, whose grave is featured in the middle picture here. Okay, Sarah Aronson, some of us had to read in school. Sarah Giborat Neely, the heroine of the Neely spy network. We will talk about the spy network in a minute. Okay, the Aronson family were one of the founding fathers of Zichron Yaakov, right? They're like the Mayflower pilgrims of the land of Israel. Zichron Yaakov is one of those first pioneering first Aliyah communities in 1882. The Aronson family comes to Zichron Yaakov. They have five children. Their eldest child is a man named Aaron Aronson, who, unlike the other pioneers at Zichron Yaakov, is not content to merely be a farmer, but he becomes an agronomist. Okay? He becomes an agronomist and a botanist, and he studies the land and he studies the plants. He's multilingual. He's very successful. He actually owns the first car in the land of Israel. And he travels all over, classifying, categorizing all the plants that he finds. And he becomes world famous for discovering what you see in the picture on the left here. And that's called emmer wheat, which is called in Hebrew, em hachita, or the mother of all wheat. This is considered to be the ancestor of almost all the domesticated wheat that we have today comes from this strain of emmer wheat. And he researched this and he published it and it made him famous. He went to America on a lecture tour and he was able to get a lot of money to make a botanical, agricultural research station in Atlit. And he becomes a very well-known man. But at the same time, hey, okay, he is deeply involved in the spy network that whose acronym is NILI. It stands for Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker. The Eternal of Israel will not be false or will not lie. And he and his siblings, as well as some others like Yosef Lishansky and Avshalom Feinberg joined together to create this secret network that will spy on the Turks on behalf of the British. This is happening during World War I. And his scientific endeavors are tied up with his spying endeavors. Okay, his research station in Atzilit is also the place where they leave information that they've gathered, and British warships come every once in a while to collect it. He is called on by the Turkish government in 1915 to deal with the locust plague. While he does that, he's recording Turkish troop movements during the war. So it's really a fascinating combination of events. The spy network, its members mostly have tragic ends. The most famous one is Sarah, who was the one who's left behind when all the others kind of scatter to do their various things or are caught. And she is caught by the Ottoman Turks. She's tortured. She refuses to give up any names of her compatriots. And she ends up committing suicide rather than telling who else is working with her. Another of the members is someone named Avshalom Feinberg. This is his grave on the right here. He was reburied on Mount Herzl. What happened to him? He and another member, Yosef Lishansky, went to Egypt in order to bring information to the British. They are murdered by Bedouin in the Sinai in the desert, he's murdered. Sorry, Yosef Lishansky escapes. Avshalom Feinberg is murdered. He is buried in the desert. Now, the fascinating story is if you can see in the picture, right, here's his grave. Right behind his grave is a palm tree. Okay, a date palm. This is not by accident. Okay. After 1967, Israeli soldiers went down to the Sinai, and Bedouin there showed them a palm tree that they said was the place of the grave of the Jew. Okay. Avshalom Feinberg. It turns out Avshalom Feinberg had dates in his pocket when he was killed. He was buried with the dates, and one of the dates grew into a palm tree. And that's how we were able to actually find his body, bring it back, rebury it in Har Herzl, and there's the tree nearby. So we have a tree again as part of our story. So Aaron Aronson is definitely one of the early pioneers. Okay. Later than him, but I put him in here because he's really one of the revolutionary people in understanding botany and Tanakh. Okay, we have two different people here. One is the gentleman on the left, Rabbi Dr. Emmanuel Lau. Okay, not maybe he's related, but not the Lau of Israel today. This is a Hungarian rabbi. Okay, who actually lives an amazingly long life. He lives from 1854 to 1944. He dies in Nazi-occupied Budapest. But he is one of the very first rabbis to write about the flora of the land of Israel. And he writes these detailed books explaining the biology, explaining what are the actual plants that are mentioned in Tanakh. He never went to the land of Israel. He never visited, but he really knew a lot in terms of languages, in terms of botany. And someone who really considered himself to be the student of Dr. Lau is Professor Yehuda Felix. Professor Yehuda Felix, much more modern, right? He lived from 1922 to 2005. And he wrote the real classics for anybody who studies Tanakh or who studies Mishnah and wants to know about plants and animals. Felix is your basic reference work, right? You can see I have a few books here, Atzomeach V'Achai V'Mishnah, say Prelimineum, Tzimchei HaTanach V'Chazal, right? And he has these very meticulously, if not colorfully illustrated books, where he has these, line drawings of different plants, of different animals, helping us to identify plants and animals that really have been misidentified for centuries. So that's Yehuda Felix, also really very much a pioneer in this field. But let's go back to kind of university scholars. And here's where we get to the very interesting story of Ephraim and Chana HaReuveni. Right? That's them on the right, also on the left. So Ephraim and Chana HaReuveni came to the land of Israel in 1906 from Ukraine as part of the Second Aliyah, right? We know the Second Aliyah was very groundbreaking in terms of many things in Zionism, in terms of Jewish self-defense and the kibbutz and the health funds and all sorts of things. Art, Boris Schatz and Bezalel, the HaReuvenis are into, for lack of a better term, botanical Zionism. Okay? They come here and they decide that they want to know all of the plants of Tanakh. And not only do they want to know them, they want to collect them. And that's what they do. And they start to collect in their home in Jerusalem all different plants of Tanakh. In 1926, a year after the founding of the Hebrew University, they move their collection to Hebrew University. They start to teach botany in Hebrew University. They are very interesting because they took an approach which sounds very modern today. It was kind of looked down upon in the 20s and 30s. They were very interdisciplinary. They said, we don't want to just know botany. We want to know Judaism, and we want to know languages, and we want to use all of those various tools from different fields in order to really understand the botany of Tanakh. And that was kind of at odds with the more kind of straight-laced scientific, we're going to learn botany and just botany and the categorization and how it works. And they were more, looking at many different worlds. They had a wonderful plan to create what they wanted to call a Gan HaNevi'im V'Chachmei HaTalmud, right? A garden of the prophets and the scholars of the Talmud, which would connect all sorts of people to nature, to Tanakh. Its centerpiece would be a large menorah, okay, which they believed was echoed in a plant called the marva, or the moriah, as they called it in Hebrew, the sage. We'll see it in a few minutes. They had the support of all sorts of interesting people, Chaim Nachman Bialik and Rav Kook and Henrietta Zold. But despite all that, it didn't happen. Okay. 1948, the Hebrew University on Mount Scopus stayed in Israeli hands, but it's surrounded by Jordanians, and the university has to move. And they move and they take their collection with them back to their house. And even though they try to get this garden going, it doesn't happen. However, they are fortunate to have a son and a daughter, Noga and Ayelet HaShachar HaReuveni, who kept their dream alive, primarily Noga. But both of them were very involved in understanding the plants of Eretz Yisrael, going and teaching the army about them, all kinds of amazing things. But in the 60s, Noga HaReuveni said, I am going to make my parents' dream come true. And he bought this kind of barren piece of land right next to the Green Line. This is 1965, right near what today is Modi'in. And he had this dream that he's going to have a garden of the seven species and a garden of the four species, and he's going to have a lake. And he actually made it come true in an amazing way. The symbol of Ne'el Kedumim is the caper bush, which you can see on the left here, and we'll see why when we get to the caper bush a little later this evening. But the other picture I brought here, besides the lake, which is kind of the centerpiece of this beautiful garden, On the right here, you have one of the many Sukkot, one of the things that Neo Kedumim does, and every year it's a big attraction on the holiday of Sukkot, is that they build the Sukkot of the Mishnah, right? If you learn Masechet Sukkot, you learn that there are all different kinds of Sukkot. Some are okay, some are not, and there are all kinds of fantastic ones, like can you build a sukkah on top of a camel? Can you build a sukkah that has an animal as one of its walls? Can you build a sukkah that's very tall? They build all those sukkahs. And you can walk around and you could say, oh, kosher, puzzle, right? It's fabulous. Okay, back to the Haruvenis. Hey, the Haruvenis, alongside their venture to collect and to catalog all of the plants of Eretz Yisrael, they want to create an encyclopedia. And in order to do that, they need someone to draw these plants in great detail. And they turn to someone whose name is Shmuel Charuvi. Shmuel Charuvi was born in the Ukraine. He was not born as Shmuel Charuvi. He's one of my favorite Hebraicized names. His real name was Shmuel Boxer. Hey, those of us who know a little bit of Yiddish know Boxer is a Carib, as is a Charuv. Okay, so he came to Israel. He didn't want to be Shmuel Boxer. He became Shmuel Charuvi. Already when he was a young man, like young in his early teens, his parents saw that he had artistic talent, and they sent him to Odessa to study art. He was going to continue on to Paris, except that in Odessa he meets someone who changes his destiny, and that's a man named Boris Schatz. Okay? Boris Schatz is the founder of Bezalel, okay? The first Zionist Jewish art school. Bezalel convinces him to make Aliyah instead of going to Paris. So in 1914, he's 17 years old. He goes, moves to the land of Israel, moves to Jerusalem, joins the school of Bezalel, and his mission is to portray the landscapes of the land of Israel. But alongside those kinds of paintings, he does these amazingly detailed botanical drawings. So if you look, you can see we have a few great ones here on the bottom. This is a rakefet, a cyclamen. Right? Over here we have the caper that we talked about before in all its detail. The bud, the flower, the fruit, right? The whole thing. We have the chatzav or the dreamia. We'll get to that a little later. And on the right here, we have something that's called the Moriah Israelite, okay? Or it's also called Marva. And you can see how you can understand why the Haruvenis thought it looked like a menorah, right? And they thought this was a plant that really expressed the idea of the menorah. Now, Shmuel Charuvi, these gorgeous drawings, he didn't fade into obscurity. He had sort of several exhibits. He continued painting till the end of his life. But these drawings, the encyclopedia never came out. And these drawings kind of got forgotten until the early 2000s, when they were rediscovered, and the Israel Museum did an exhibit about them and then put out a beautiful book, which you can still buy today, which has a very nice, foreword about the artist and about the whole idea of botany and Eretz Yisrael, and put out all of these gorgeous pictures. It's called Shirat HaAsamim. So that's Shmuel Charuvi. Okay, someone else who is the same time period but goes in a different direction is Alexander Eig. Alexander Eig, like all these guys, comes from Eastern Europe. He's from Minsk. He comes to the land of Israel at 14 years old, and he's fascinated by botany. And he travels around. He makes a map of the various regions where different plants grow. His best friend and his partner throughout his life was somebody named Elazar Faktorovsky. He actually marries his sister. Right, all kinds of interesting connections there. And he is the first person to write a book that's a plant glossary, right? A Magdir Tzmachim. The picture in the middle is an updated version of his. I couldn't find a picture of his, but he's really the first one to have I'm missing the word that I want, but the book that you look at to identify your flowers. He goes to Hebrew University. He gets a PhD in botany, and in 1931, he is the founder of the first botanical gardens in the land of Israel. Actually, the first botanical gardens in the Middle East, and that's in Hebrew University. Not like what the Haruvenis wanted with all the connections to Tanakh, but really kind of pure science. We want to just have the different kinds of plant that are here in our region. And in the picture on the right here, he is digging a hole to plant the very first tree there. He also, fascinating enough, right, all of these interconnections. When the British convened the Peel Commission to determine how to divide up the land of Israel, he is brought in to testify that the land of Israel can sustain many more people than are living here already, right? One of the British claims was, oh, the land is not, cannot produce enough to sustain so many people that you Jews want to bring. And he was brought in to testify the opposite. As you can see from his dates here, he died tragically young. He had cancer. But his legacy really lives on in the botanical gardens of the Hebrew University. Now, the idea was to create a garden that had all the plants of the land of Israel and also surrounding areas in the Middle East. He went to Syria and Iraq and Turkey and Lebanon, and he brought back plants. Everything was classified, put and planted by habitats. Okay? The Biblical Zoo, which we're going to talk about when we do our class on animals, actually had its first home here in the botanical gardens until 1950. But of course, everything changed in 1948 when the War of Independence breaks out. Mount Scopus has to be abandoned as a university. It's a military outpost, but it's abandoned as a university. The botanical gardens is essentially abandoned as well. It's still there, but it's neglected for 19 years. At the time, Hebrew University eventually moves to the western side of the city to Givat Ram, and they decide to open up a new botanical gardens, first on the campus in Givat Ram. Then later they raise money, and in the 1980s, they build a much larger garden adjacent to the campus. Today, it's no longer affiliated with the campus. It's its own freestanding, beautiful botanical gardens. But surprise is that after the Six-Day War, Hebrew University went back to the Mount Scopus campus, had two campuses, and in the 80s as well, they got the money to renew the botanical gardens on Mount Scopus. And today you can go there, and it really is a beautiful oasis on the campus. In general, it's just a beautiful campus. And this is one of the beautiful, quiet spots that still has its scientific mission intact. You really can see all of these different plants and wander around. And it's just a nice, quiet space for students to go and study, but it has a lot of intrinsic value. And one of the surprises in the botanical gardens, if you're just wandering around and wanting some nature, is to come upon archaeology. Hey, in the very early part of the 20th century, the land of Hebrew University that is going to eventually be built on was bought by a British Christian Zionist, right, named Sir John Grahill, who wants to build himself a beautiful home on this mountain overlooking the old city. And in the course of doing so, he and his family uncover burial caves that go back to Second Temple times, right? And if you look, you can see this is classic Second Temple period Jewish burial. You have these niches for the ossuaries, for the bone boxes, it's very, very amazing and beautiful. Not something so unusual. We have these in other places, but what's really very special is that one of the ossuaries has an inscription on it. You can see it below. It has three lines in Greek and then just two words in Hebrew. Okay, in Hebrew, it says Hebrew or Aramaic, it says Nicanor Alexa, as in Nicanor from Alexandria. And in Greek, it says Nicanor, who made the gates. Okay, now we know from rabbinic literature that there is a Jew named Nicanor who comes from Alexandria who wants to give a gift to the temple. And so he creates these beautiful copper gates, and he has to bring them by ship. And there's a terrible storm, and one of the gates is thrown overboard to lighten the load. And when they get to the port, once that gate is waiting on the beach, and the rabbis are so amazed by this miracle that they put these gates in a prominent place in the temple, right? In the area between the women's court and the Azara. It's a very nice story. But here we have archaeological proof. Nicanor, who made the gates, he was so connected to Jerusalem that he decided to be buried here. And his grave was found on Mount Scopus. Somebody who was very impressed by the story and by these burial caves was a Zionist activist named Menachem Muzishkin. Menachem Muzishkin was the head of the JNF that we're going to be talking about in a moment. And he decided that not only should there be, ancient graves here, but there should be modern graves here. And this should be the place of a Zionist pantheon. And to start off the Zionist pantheon, he would have two graves there. One is of a fellow named Leo Pinsker, the founder of the Chovevei Zion, Tzion, the Lovers of Zion movement. And the other one is Menachem Muzishkin. Because who's a more important Zionist than him? And he arranges for Pinsker's bones to be brought from Odessa and reinterred in the cave. And he arranges that when he dies, he should also be buried there. However, best laid plans, this never became a pantheon because, again, War of Independence, and this was cut off. And instead, Mount Herzl became the place of the cemetery of the great leaders. But that's just a side note to the botanical gardens, but a very interesting one. Okay, let's talk a little about trees. Okay, so now that we have our botanists, we're going to get to some different kinds of plants and trees in Eretz Israel. So, but first, we have a phenomenon, the phenomenon of holy trees. Okay, now this is a very interesting thing, and I assume it's true in other places and not only in the land of Israel, but you have a phenomenon of a tree that has a very interesting cycle. For some reason or other, it's considered to be holy. Now we know holy trees, right? The Bible talks about not praying at the Asherah, right? An Asherah is a tree, a holy tree. Okay. So it's a focal point of worship. And some trees seem to have gotten this designation as a holy tree. And then it's a holy tree, so nobody cuts it down. So it becomes old. And when it's old, people look at it and say, oh, it's so old, it's so great, it must be a holy tree. So they don't cut it down, right? Continuing and continuing. So we have a phenomenon of certain trees in the land of Israel that are really very ancient. And if not for disease, they could live for, or old age, they could live forever. Nobody's going to cut them down. So I brought you a few examples here. The most famous one, certainly the most famous one in my part of the country, is the one on the left, and that is the lone tree, the Alon HaBoded in Gush Etzion, right? The lone tree, which is a European oak tree, Alon Tavor, is a tree that became the symbol of Gush Etzion, because when Gush Etzion was captured by the Jordanians and destroyed, and the Jews were exiled for 19 years, this was the tree that people could see on the horizon. And when we were able to return to Gush Etzion, the tree became a symbol of the Gush. It's give or take 600 years old. Nobody knows exactly. Not super healthy these days, but still there and a beautiful tree. The tree on the right is also a very interesting one. This is a tree that is called the Alon of Rabbi Chalafta. Hey, Rabbi Chalafta, one of the Tanaim, right? A contemporary of Rabbi Akiva. This is a tree in the north, in the Upper Galilee. Rabbi Chalafta himself lived in Tzipori, but his grave is supposed to be here, not too far from Tzfat. And this is a tree that also has been living for centuries. Two more, okay, on the left is a shizaf. Shizaf in English is called a jujube. This is a tree that is near Eilat, right, in near Chatzeva, Ein Chatzeva. There's a spring there. Because there's a spring, it never dried out. It kept on growing. Some people think this is the oldest tree in Israel and suggest that it might even be 2,000 years old. On the right are trees that many Christians believe to be some of the oldest trees in Israel. These are olive trees in the Garden of Gethsemane at the foot of the Mount of Olives that, according to believing Christians, are trees that go back to the time of Jesus. Okay, so there are trees that can live a very, very long life, centuries, occasionally a millennium, but centuries definitely. So you have this this amazing phenomenon of these very old, very beautiful trees. Then we have phenomenon of different trees that are not indigenous to the land of Israel. Probably the most famous imported tree in Eretz Israel is the one on the left here, and that's the eucalyptus. Hey, why do we bring the eucalyptus? It's brought in Australia in the late 19th century. The belief was that the eucalyptus is such a thirsty tree, it's going to drain the swamps. Hey, so they planted them near Hadera, where there were swamps and malaria. They planted them in the Jezreel Valley. Is this really true? Unclear. But what is true is that the Turks cut down many trees because they needed wood for railroad fuel. So they cut down many of the forests in the land of Israel, and they needed more trees. So these trees grow quickly, and there are many of them in the land of Israel. They are good for the bees because they flower a lot. So that's a plus. Bees are very important. As we know, they are in crisis all over the world. The other tree on the right is a very weird tree. I don't know if you can tell from the picture what it looks like, but this is called a Ficus Bengali. Okay. These are trees that are brought and planted in Jaffa. They're planted in the Jordan Valley. They're planted in the agricultural school of Mikveh Yisrael. What is special about them? Their roots, they have what are called air roots. Their roots grow out of branches and then grow down into the ground and become trunks themselves. So they're very bizarre trees, but very beautiful, and they can spread and become enormous. Now, if we talk about trees, we of course have to talk about the JNF, the Keren Kayemet. Okay. JNF was founded in 1901. Right. It's part of this whole project of the state in the making, the Zionist Congresses. How are we going to buy land? Right. 1901, we're only a few years into the Zionist Congresses. And this is one of the earliest, Zionist organizations. Collect money to buy land, and eventually to plant trees. What's the name from? Keren Kayemet, right? We know from the Mishnah, HaKeren Kayemet La'olam Haba, right? You could do certain things that you get their reward in this world, but you also have the dividends, right? Pay out in the next world. And that was the idea of Keren Kayemet. You could give a little money and your legacy will live on forever. This was an idea of someone named Herman Shapira, who suggested it at the Zionist Congress. He's also one of the people behind the idea of Hebrew University. And the brilliance of the JNF, at least in the early years, was this concept that everybody will participate in this land buying. Unlike earlier, ventures in the Jewish world where we relied on big philanthropists, Keren Kayemet also relied on philanthropists. But the idea here was from the ground up. Every Jewish household will have one of these boxes. Every child once a week will put in a little bit of their stucco money, right? And little by little, everyone will take part in buying land in the land of Israel. Okay, there also were stamps that you could collect. And the idea is that this is something that is belonging to all the Jewish people, right? Menachem Muzishkin, the head of the Keren Kayemet, says it's not the child that gives to the Keren Kayemet, but rather the fund that gives to the child a lofty ideal for all of the days of his life. Okay, so a lot of the land in Eretz Israel is bought by Keren Kayemet and leased to the property holder rather than sold. Okay, and the JNF, the Keren Kayemet, was very, very good at really spreading this message very strongly. Hey, buy a tree in Israel, buy a tree for your bar mitzvah, buy a tree for your bat mitzvah, right? This is something that I think we're all very familiar with, as well as all of these propaganda campaigns, right? Here's Australia campaign. These posters are amazing. Anybody who owns any of these posters, I love them, right? The plow breaks through the restrictions, right? The British are putting up restrictions, but the plow is going to break through. And all of these really wonderful posters that are promoting this idea of the JNF. In the beginning, the original JNF forests are planted with evergreens, are planted with pine trees. And anyone who's traveled around in Israel and has seen JNF forests, you've seen those tree, those evergreens covering acres and acres and acres of land. The idea being that that's what a forest looks like, right? Certainly, if you come from Europe, that's what a forest looks like. Eventually, in the last few decades, at least 30 years, maybe more, we have come to realize that those are not really very good trees for the land of Israel. Yes, it's good to have trees, and trees are very good for the environment, but these particular trees are not wonderful choices. They are very flammable, right? They create forest fires, spread very quickly. And better that we should have indigenous species that really know how to grow in this land. And so more recent Keren Kayamet forests are planted with carob trees, with olive trees, with pomegranate trees, right? With trees that really are connected to the land of Israel. The JNF has been accused of not being transparent, of having too much money, of paying too high salaries. There have been a lot of controversies connected to the JNF. They have done amazing things, but there is this widespread belief that they just have too much money and they don't know what to do with it. Their main offices are in on King George Street, and that's what you see here. But I also brought you this picture over here from the famous scene from the amazing movie Salach Shabati. And if people who don't know it, I will tell you briefly, but you should definitely go and see it yourself. Salach Shabati, the new immigrant, is set to work in Yiur, in forestry, even though he has no idea, he's never seen a forest, right? But he has to go and he has to plant these trees. And one day he's planting these saplings. Some guy drives up in a fancy car, takes out a sign, knocks it into the ground. A few minutes later, a very fancy couple drive up, and they get out, and he says, "This is your forest, Mr. Birnbaum." Right? And they say, "Ooh, ah," and they take pictures, and they get back in the car, and they drive away. The guy pulls out the sign, knocks in another sign, "Goodman Forest, this is your forest." Right? So that was always the joke about the JNF, that they're collecting all this money. Where exactly is it going? Today, the JNF is not planting trees as much as dealing with other challenges. Thank God we have many, many trees. Like we said, more trees at the end of the 20th century than at the beginning, which is very unusual in most countries in the world. So today the JNF has taken on different challenges. Some of them are kind of recreational. You can't go hiking or picnicking in Israel without coming on a JNF campground or a hiking trail or all kinds of beautiful recreational areas. And that's an amazing thing. But they've also done on a kind of a deeper level, they work with water resources. They work with planting in the desert, dealing with infrastructure in developing towns, rehabilitating polluted rivers. So there are wonderful things that the JNF has taken on. I didn't mean to, poke fun at the JNF, but they do have some things they need to fix, but they have done many, many amazing things in Eretz Israel. Okay, let's take a look at a few different kinds of plants. Right? So we started off with the almond, with the shaked. Okay, shaked and the shkedia. Okay, this is one of those plants that are included in what's called the Zimrat Haaretz, right? If you remember the story of Yosef, right, and the famine in Eretz Yisrael, and the brothers are reluctant to go back to the man, right, who they don't know is Yosef, who is holding their brother prisoner, but they need more food. And Yaakov says, okay, at least take with you a bribe. Take with you mizimrat haaretz, right? Well, what does that mean? It's a famine. How do they have any food? Because they have food of things that are able to grow even without a lot of water. Okay. And that's various kinds of nuts and seeds. And the almonds are one of those. Now, one of the fascinating things about the shaked we mentioned is the first to blossom. Okay. And so it's considered to be a symbol of something that's going to happen quickly. With resolve, right? It's not like it's not going to happen. It's definitely going to happen. And we have two great examples of this. Okay? One is what I wrote here in the title. Kishoked ani advarai lasoto. In the very beginning of the book of Jeremiah, hey, God says, Yirmiyahu, ma ata roeh, Yirmiyahu, what do you see, Jeremiah? And he says, makel shaked ani roeh, I see an almond branch. Hey, and God says, that's because I'm going to be diligent, shoked, even today, modern Hebrew, you're a shoked or you're a shakdan. You're somebody who's diligent, who works hard. And God says, I'm going to be diligent and I'm going to do what I said I'm going to do. I'm not going to back down. I'm going to do it when the time comes, when the time is right. Okay, so that's one use of the shaked. The other use we have in the story of Korach, right? In Sefer Bamidbar, we have Korach and his rebellion against Moshe and his rebellion against Aaron and the priests. And after Korach is swallowed up, the people are very dissatisfied and they say, well, how can it be? You know, that who said that Aaron is chosen? And Moshe does this challenge and he collects from all of the different tribes branches, puts them all in one place. And the only branch that flowers is the branch of Levi, is the branch of Aaron, because he's the chosen one. So again, quick flowering, something that's going to get done no matter what. So that's our shaked. Okay? Another plant that's a little less well known, at least today, but was very well known in ancient times and was a source of a lot of wealth, is something called the balsam plant. Now it's a little confusing because in Hebrew it's called the afarsimon. And in our literature, we hear in Chazal, we hear about the afarsimon. Today in modern Hebrew, if you go to the supermarket and you want to get an afarsimon, it's a persimmon, okay? Persimmon, those orange fruits. That's not what we're talking about, okay? Afarsimon in rabbinic Hebrew is a plant called the balsam plant, and you can see it botanically drawn here very nicely. What's special about the balsam plant? You can make, it seems, we don't know, we're trying to redo this today, but it seems that you could make an amazing perfume from it. Okay? Now, the afarsimon grows very nicely in warm climates. And in the picture over here on the right, okay, this is a section of the Medva map. Okay? This is an ancient mosaic map from the 5th century, and you can see the Dead Sea the Jordan River flowing into the Dead Sea, and you can see this nice little balsam plant growing here along the Jordan River, because the area near the Dead Sea, near the Jordan, very warm. City of Jericho grew balsam. The city of En Gedi grew balsam. Why? Because they made a lot of money from it. You could make this fabulous perfume. So we have a few really neat statements about the balsam. And I just brought you a few here. Gemara in Brachot over here. Rabbi Chiska said to Rabbi Yitzchak, what blessing is said over balsam oil, right? Shemen afarsimon. You can make oil from it, not just perfume. So he said, Rabbi Yehuda said, who created the oil of our land, borei shemen artzeinu. So he said to him, leaving out Rabbi Yehuda, who dotes on the land of Israel, right? He's a real Zionist. What do ordinary people say? He says, Rabbi Yochanan says, who creates pleasant oil, shemen arev. Okay, so balsam oil is considered to be this very sweet smelling, very pleasant oil. However, you shouldn't use it to light your Shabbat candles. Why? Because it's very, very, very flammable. And we have a horrible story in the Gemara in Shabbat. Eh? Don't tell this story to your in-law children or your mother-in-law. A certain mother-in-law hated her daughter-in-law. She said to her, go and adorn yourself with balsam oil. She went and adorned herself. On her return, she said to her, go and light the lamp. She went and lit the lamp. A spark flew out and consumed her. Horrible story. Okay. A little bit nicer further on in the same Gemara. At the end of First Temple times, with the exile of the Jews, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left the poorest of the land to be kormim, vine dressers, and yogvim, husbandmen. What are kormim? Rabbi Yosef learned this means balsam gatherers from En Gedi to Ramah. So this was a whole profession. There's even a story that Cleopatra gave King Herod orchards for balsam near Jericho. It was something that could really make you rich. And we also know that it can make you rich because we have this fascinating kind of cryptic inscription from the synagogue in En Gedi, okay, where along with all the other usual thank you to this donor and that donor and the other donor, we have a curse, not something you usually see in a synagogue. Anyone who causes strife among his fellow men or informs on them to non-Jews or steals his friend's possessions or tells the secret of the city to non-Jews. He whose eyes roam the whole land and see everything hidden will smite that man and his children and destroy him from the earth, and everyone say amen. How would you like to see that every time you go to shul? Okay. But what does that mean, the secret of the city? What's the secret of the city? So we think that the secret is how to extract this perfume from the balsam, because that's what would have made the city of En Gedi very, very wealthy. Okay, so that's our balsam, less well known, but a very interesting plant. Okay, the caper. I promised you we'd get back to the caper. Caper in Israel, in Hebrew, is called a tzalaf. Okay, a tzalaf has rather sharp thorns, so it could be used as a fence. Everything about the caper can be used. Okay, the buds can be pickled and eaten. The flowers can be eaten. The fruits, they have fruits after the flowers die. I have a caper in my backyard. It's amazing to see the progression of the plant. The wood can be used later. Now, the Gemara says something very strange. Right? It says, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, there are three impudent ones. The Hebrew is a better word. It says there are three azim and az, okay? Bold or impudent, or we might even say chutzpedik. The Jewish people among the nations, the dog among animals, and the rooster among birds. Some say the goat among small cattle, and some say the caper bush among trees. Okay, we won't go into the other ones. The Jewish people, we can understand why we are chutzpedik, that we're still alive today. We're still hanging on. But the caper, and this is one of the reasons that Neok Dumim, this was chosen as their symbol, the caper, you can't kill it. You can't kill it. You cut it back, it grows again. It'll grow in the most inhospitable places. It doesn't need anything. It doesn't need water. And this is why people ate all the parts of it, because when everything else is going to die, the caper is going to keep on going. And this is why the caper is compared to Am Yisrael. And if you've ever gone to the Kotel or seen pictures of the Kotel and those bushes that are growing out of the Kotel, those are caper bushes. That's what that is, right? And if you can think of a more inhospitable place to grow than out of a stone wall, and that's exactly where it grows in my garden, out of a stone wall. So they don't give up. They persevere, and you can cut them back, and every spring they're going to come back again. And they really are an amazing plant. Now, because this was something that people used, right? They used everything about it. There actually was a profession that was called a kapar, kuf pei resh. And this is, you know, we said salaf is the Hebrew word, but they also use the Latin word, the caper. A kapar was someone who cultivated and pickled caper buds to eat. And in the Golan, we discovered a lintel, right? That's what this is on the bottom here. Something that goes on the top of a door. And it says, Zeu Beit Midrasho shel Rabbi Eliezer HaKapar. Rabbi Eliezer HaKapar, we know about him from the Gemara. Okay? And this is his Beit Midrash. And he didn't make his living being a teacher and having a Beit Midrash. He made his living as a Kapar. And this is his name on the wall. Okay. A plant that is not so well known outside of Israel, but all kindergartners in Israel know it, is something called the chatzav, okay, or the dreamia. Nobody calls it a dreamia. Everyone calls it a chatzav. Okay? If you have, if you're an Israeli child who goes to kindergarten here, one of the things that you learn is hachatzav poreach, hakaitz poreach. When the chatzav is blooming, that means the summer is coming to the end. The Gemara didn't have that little song, but they did know about the chatzav, and they said, Tu Bishvat, that's the end of the summer. Tu Ba'av, excuse me, not Tu Bishvat. Tu Ba'av, the end of the summer. Tu Ba'av, a lot of things happen. Among them, the days start getting shorter. They reach their peak and they start getting shorter. And the chatzav blooms, and that's when we reach the end of the summer season. It might still feel very hot outside, but we're heading in the direction towards the fall, and it's signaling to us that it's the end of the year. So that's the chatzav. And you can see them growing. They grow wild. They grow usually together in these nice little stands, and you can see them growing in vacant lots, and they are the harbinger of fall. Okay, boxer or cherub or charuv, like Shmuel Charuvi. Okay. Might also be one of the Zimrat Haaretz, where some people say the word Nechaot is a carob. Carobs have they are a fascinating tree. They're a beautiful tree. They can grow well under difficult conditions, and they have fruit, which if you grew up in a Jewish day school in America, you have been scarred by caribs because they were terrible. You get them on Tu B'Shvat. They were very dried out. But here in the land of Israel, you can pick them off the tree. They are fresh. They don't taste like chocolate, but they can keep you going. And some people think that a carob is almost as good as bread. Okay. And we have stories in the Gemara that talk about that. Okay. One about Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, as Rabbi Yehuda said, that Rav said every day a divine voice emerges from Mount Horeb and says, the entire world is sustained by the merit of Chanina ben Dosa. And for Chanina, my son, a cove of carobs is sufficient to sustain him for an entire week. From one Shabbat Eve to the next Shabbat Eve. The other person, perhaps more famous, who sustained himself on carobs for 12 years is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is, given into the Romans. He has to run away. He and his son live in a cave. The cave is, supposed to be in Piki Inn in the Galil. That's in the picture here on the right. And what did they have? A miracle occurred. A carob tree was created for them as well as a spring of water. And that's what they lived from for 12 years. Fun fact, when we talk about a carat, right? A carat as in a diamond, a carat is the same weight as a carob seed. Okay? And that was used as a measure to signify value. Okay? Now, carob trees are probably most famous for having a very long germination, right? It takes them a very long time to bear fruit. We have various versions of stories about that in the Gemara. One is about Choni HaMa'agel, who plants a carob tree and then falls asleep for 70 years and he wakes up and the tree is bearing fruit. But perhaps the more famous story is in the Gemara in Tanit. One day he was walking along the road and we saw a certain man planting a carob tree. Oh, this is the one with Choni, sorry. There's a variation on this with a Roman soldier. Okay. I put in this one. Choni said to him, this tree, after how many years will it bear fruit? The man said to him, it will not produce fruit until 70 years have passed. This is not actually biologically true, but it does take a long time for them to have fruit. Choni said to him, is it obvious to you that you will live 70 years, that you expect to benefit from this tree? He said to him, that man himself, meaning him, found a world full of carob trees. Just as my ancestors planted for me, I too am planting for my descendants. This story, the idea that we plant for our descendants, is the reason that carobs were chosen as the tree to plant in memory of the righteous or in honor of the righteous among the nations in Yad Vashem. Because not only did the righteous among the nations save the life of one person, but save the life of all their descendants to come and made a world that was fitting to continue in. Okay, another interesting plant is the ezov or the hyssop, or otherwise known as za'atar. Okay, the ezov is a small plant. It's humble. It's often juxtaposed to the cedar, to the erez, right? Erez and ezov. The erez is high and mighty. The ezov is small and humble. We hear about it in connection to purity, right? The mitzora, the leper has to be sprinkled with blood using the ezov and the erez. Okay, the para aduma also, you use the ezov and the erez to create the ashes of the red heifer. And this idea of purity is mentioned by David HaMelech, right, in Tehillim. Chataeni be'ezov, purge me with hyssop ve'etaher until I am pure. What's the connection between purity and the hyssop? Maybe this idea that in order to become pure, in order to really repent, you have to humble yourself. You have to make yourself realize that you're not as great as you think you are. Today, most of us come in contact with the ezov through its dried version, which is za'atar. According to the Arabs, za'atar is very good for memory, right? And they give it to kids for breakfast, so they'll do well in school. We also come across the ezov in the Pesach story, right? Because Bnei Israel have to take the lamb, they have to slaughter it, and they have to put the blood on their doorpost. What's the paintbrush that's used for the blood? It's an azov. So an azov is very significant in Tanakh, in ritual in Tanakh, but today we just find it kind of more as a plant and as a spice. Okay, one last unusual and interesting, two unusual and interesting plants. One is called a rose of Jericho, Shoshanat Yericho. This is a plant that is a very big deal for Christians in particular. If you walk through the old city in Jerusalem and you know, in the Shuk, and you get to spice stores, you'll see that they sell this rose of Jericho. What's special about it? It's a desert plant that in a drought, it'll dry up and roll into a ball, and it can survive like that for a few years, and you can rehydrate it. You can put water on it, and it will come back to life, right? As if it was frozen and restarted. So for obvious reasons, Christians like this resurrection. It's very cool. It's just a very neat plant. The other one, which is not quite as nice of an imagery, is what's called the Tapuach Sodom, a Sodom apple. Now, if you're in the desert and in Engedi and other places, you can see this tree, a beautiful tree that has this plump, juicy-looking fruit. And if you take it off the tree and you bite into it, you get a mouthful of fluff. Okay, it's not really a fruit; it's deceptive. Why do we call it a Tapuach Sodom, a Sodom apple? Based on the Midrash that talks about the people of Sodom and how they would offer water bottles that were completely empty so that people would think they were drinking and then they would die of thirst. And that's the Tapuach Sodom. Okay. One more plant ID and one more short thing, and we're coming to an end. Maror. Okay, Maror is an amazing example of how we've lost our plant lore when we were in the diaspora. Okay, Gemara in Pesachim talks about what can you use for maror at the Seder. It gives five different plants: chazeret, olshin, tamcha, charchavina, and maror. Okay, what are these plants? Chazeret is the only one we know for sure. Chazeret is chasa, is lettuce. I'll show you a picture of it in a minute. It's what many of us use for our maror. The others are There are variations on what they are. Some people say endive. Another suggestion for Olshin. A suggestion for Charchavina is this plant over here, Eryngium criticum. Okay, the maror is this sow thistle. Okay, this is actually what the Samaritans use for maror. The similarity among all of the plants that are suggested is that they start off kind of soft and not so sweet, but palatable. And as they get older, they get harder and they get more bitter. And there's this amazing parallel, of course, to our time in Egypt, where things start off well, and then as time passes, we understand the true nature of the Egyptians. Okay, so understanding what are these plants? These are all plants that kind of grow wild. They're not plants that you would necessarily give a second thought to. We tend to eat chasa, chazeret, right? Same, another nice pun. Chas HaKadosh Baruch Hu Al Yisrael, God has mercy on us. But those of us who are from an Ashkenazi extraction might put some chrain on our Seder plate. And the question is why, right? And this is a great example of losing the identity of the plant. In the 17th century, you have a rabbi named Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, who says the tamcha of the Gemara is horseradish root. And this idea took hold, probably because it was easy to get horseradish root as opposed to the other things. It is most definitely not the maror of the Gemara. And now we've come back to Eretz Yisrael, and we really understand what the Gemara was talking about. Okay, finally, for the 70th anniversary of Israel, I don't remember which ministry, but some ministry decided to hold contests for national species. So we had winners. So the winner for the, we'll do the animals when we do animals, but the winner for the flowers, of course, is the kalanit, the anemone, which blossoms in the spring and is incredibly beautiful. And the winner for the trees is the olive tree. Okay. And finally, we have an institute in Rishon LeZion called the Volcani Center, okay, founded early pre-state years. And they are involved in creating all kinds of new delicious fruits and vegetables that end up on your table, like seedless watermelon, okay, like all kinds of varieties of melons and tomatoes and zucchinis and all these amazing Israeli innovations. But Israeli agricultural innovations are not only about new fruits, oh, pomelit also, okay? It's also about irrigation techniques. It's also about agriculture in the desert, pest control in natural ways, right? All kinds of amazing stuff. So let us take a look in the minute that we have left at the chat. All right, let's see. A Haggadah by an agronomist, pre-Chirut. Oh, that sounds very cool. Okay, Loi equals Lau. Yeah, but I don't know if he's connected to Lau. I don't know. The first Gulf War led to the discovery that unbeknownst to them, Neil Qadumim was actually sitting on a major archaeological site. Yes, I know that that is true, but I did not know it was from the Gulf War. So you'll have to tell us more about that.
A Scud missile flew over my house. It was short.
Really?
It flew right
Thank
over
God.
my house. They couldn't find it, but there were marks from the rocket fuel in the windshield of my car, embedded into the
Oh my
windshield.
God.
They went and looked. They wanted to find it, and they used aerial surveillance to look, and they found glints of metal. And so they went and they looked, and instead of finding the
Yeah.
remnants of the Scud, they found coins from the Maccabee era. And that was the beginning.
Amazing.
And then
Amazing.
they dug. That's how it happened.
I know about the site, but I never knew that story. Thank you very much. That's a great story. And I'm glad that you were not harmed. Nobody was harmed in the making of that story.
I live in Moshav Matityahu, and so it's right overhead. If
It's
it
right
flew,
near there, of
literally
course.
flew right overhead.
Amazing. Thank you. All right. Everybody's telling how much their Keren Kayemet stamps cost. Oh, JNF does, yes, Miyuchadim B'Madim is how it's called in Hebrew. Right. That's very nice. Very special. I didn't know that they were involved with that. They definitely do make parks accessible, and they also are involved, it seems, with helping special needs people serve in the army. California almonds are water intensive, yes, but not here. I don't know the difference, but I guess it's a different type of almond. Supreme Court has ruled against some policies. Yes, there's been a whole controversy. I don't know about the rulings, but I know there's been a controversy about selling land to Arabs. Can you lease land? Can there be communities, Keren Kayemet, own land that's not given to Arabs? Yes, there's definitely been stuff about that. The Balm of Gilead is from the balsam. No, Tseri b'Gilead. Tseri is a different plant. I would have to look and see what it is, but it's not the same thing. A tzalaf is a sniper. Yes, I don't know the connection between the tzalaf and the tzalaf. Pitu maktor, yain kafrisim is an extract of the caper bush. It's good we have so many people who know so much stuff. That is very good. Yellow flower looks like a dandelion. Yeah, all of these are weeds. Right? They're all weeds. You would never give them a second look, but that's what the people ate, things in the old days that we would never eat today. In Russia, you can't get greens for Pesach. Yes, for sure. Wild romaine was very bitter. And yes, there is definitely a well-known song called Kalaniyot. And I will end with that because Kalaniyot will bring us back to our reality in Israel. One of the things that the communities that were attacked a few weeks ago were famous for, a much more positive connotation, is the Darom Adom Festival, right? This festival where people go every February to see all the gorgeous red Kalaniyot that are blooming in these areas of Otef Aza. Thank you, everybody. Should have
Hi,
a good,
Shuli.
safe week. Hi, Rabbi Kalman. You came in at the
I just caught
clinch.
the last 5 minutes. That's all.
Okay.
Anyways,
Did you
all right.
hear
I hope.
Mr. Stein's amazing story?
Yes, I got on like 2 minutes before that story. Yes, thank you, thank you. So, all right. I hope you're well. Hope your kids are okay, and whatever.
Le'ayin hara.
Good
We're
news.
waiting, a lot of waiting, a waiting game.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
Oh,
next
yeah.
week
Oh,
you're
yeah.
back. Okay. And this, of course, was an unexpected class, right? I guess, out of this whole thing, we got this class. And of course, in 10 minutes, Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Brody will be beginning his series on ethical issues in end of life care. He'll be talking today on can we pray for a terminally ill patient to die? It's a very interesting question in halakha. Rabbi Brody, of course, is the executive director of Ematai. He's a graduate of Harvard. He used to wrote the book, The Halakha of the Complex. And he wrote for many years, column in Jerusalem Post, was a Rebbe in Yeshiva Dakota for a while, a very learned and wonderful time. He was at our medical ethics conference that we did live back in May. So that's 2:15, like in 10 minutes. And tonight, Rabbi Nadi Helfgott, Nathaniel Helfgott from Teaneck will be beginning his year-long series on Sefer Melachim Beit. That's at 8:30 this evening. And tomorrow evening at 8:30, Rushain, who I see here, will be giving the Parshat HaShavua Shir tomorrow night at 8:30. And then please go on my Siddur Shir at 9:30. And then on Monday, Rabbi Matthew Nitzanim will be starting from the other end, issues on medical ethics. He's doing a PhD in bioethics. He'll be doing a class on beginning of life issues. That's beginning this Monday. We'll send out an email about that, a new series beginning of his debut, a young up and coming scholar. That'll be this Monday night, this Monday afternoon. We'll be starting, and Mark Shapiro, who finished the Letters of the Rav on Monday, will be starting on back to our original series of great rabbinic figures, Rav Shaul Zelig Bamberger, the Würzburger Rav, who, very famously, or maybe not so famously, I don't know, but was involved in the dispute with Rav Shimshon Feil Hirsch about whether we should separate from the non-Orthodox or not, and Rav Bamberger felt we should not. But anyways, that's just going to be part of this series. So that's some upcoming things. Most importantly, we should hear good news from Israel, and our prayer should be answered, and our learning should serve as a schut. And listen, I think the learning is a sense of normalcy. It's important because it's important, but it's in addition, it's a sense of normalcy, I think, which we could all use. Okay, so I'm going to take a few minute break, and then we'll see you. Please, God, stay. You don't have to go anywhere. 9 minutes, Rabbi Brody will be beginning. Okay, thank you, everybody. Okay, I didn't do anything, but okay, listen, I think it's amazing, all these speakers from Israel. I mean, Shuli's got 4 kids in the army, I think, as we speak. And I know one of her name is 5. I mean, you know, this is we're in Kutzarts. It's a different situation. But anyways, okay, we should hear good things.